This is the River Radius, a cultural nexus of rivers, people, and boats. I am your host, Sam Carter. Welcome.
The term atmospheric river applies anywhere around the world where the criteria are met. Large volume of water vapor transport is really the key parameter. They occur not only in the Northwest and Alaska, but also in the Southeast and the East Coast. Some of the biggest, wettest, strongest nor'easters have a strong atmospheric river embedded in them. Other parts of the world have atmospheric rivers that hit the west coast of Europe, west coast of South America, southern Africa, Australia, New Zealand. They are a phenomena that occurs not just in the West.
This episode comes to you from a river in the sky miles above the ocean. Atmospheric river is the name of a weather pattern that delivers acute moisture in narrow paths to continents. Over the past few years, the term atmospheric river has become regular nomenclature in the vernacular of weather forecasting and in the more informal chatter about moisture content in the western United States. So what is an atmospheric river? Is it trendy? How much water is in there? Where do they come from and where do they go? And why do we care? For this episode, our guest is Marty Ralph. Marty is the director and founder of the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes at Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. 12 months ago, I did not know who Marty was, and I thought atmospheric rivers were a trendy term. And at that same time, the West had experienced an incredible winter full of snow and moisture, and the spring was letting that moisture run down the mountains. In May of 2023, myself and Marty Ralph were both participants on the YRAP trip. YRAP is the Yampa River Awareness Project, an annual river trip hosted by American Rivers and Friends of the Yampa. This is a guided trip of weather experts, water policy experts, water and river managers, conservation experts, scientists, and a few media members. I was one of the media outfits. This trip is also where the episode What is a River 2023 came from last year when I was able to fly above the flooded Yampa and learn from Yampa expert hydrologist about the value of a river experiencing high water. So back to Marty and YRAP. I recall at the boat ramp, we were all politely and eagerly getting to know each other, somewhat similar to kids on the first day of camp. I was standing and listening, and I started to hear Marty talk to someone else about atmospheric rivers, snowfall, his research, and how he was able to fly in research planes above the atmospheric rivers to study them. I walked in closer, listened, asked a few questions. Eventually, we all got in boats and went down the river, spending several days together. I learned a lot, and I asked Marty for an interview. He said yes. So, this February of 2024, 9 months after that first meeting, Marty and I got together for an interview where he helped me, and I hope you, learn about atmospheric rivers. You will hear atmospheric rivers called by their full name, and often you will simply hear AR to reference the longer stated atmospheric river. Please meet Marty Ralph and the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes.
My name is Marty Ralph.
And Marty, tell me your job title, where you live, where you work, those basics.
I'm the founding director of the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which is part of University of California, San Diego. I live near La Jolla, California, and have been here for about 10 years.
Well, let's just get into it. Can you tell us all listening what an atmospheric river is?
Sure thing. An atmospheric river is really a river in the sky, but it's a river of water vapor pushed by the wind rather than liquid carried by gravity.
It's really that simple.
It's just the size is very different because the density of water vapor is 1,000 times less than liquid. Uh-huh. So they're hundreds of miles wide and thousands of miles long in many cases, and they transport a lot more water than a terrestrial river. An average atmospheric river transports the equivalent of 25 times what the Mississippi dumps into the Gulf of Mexico.
And when you say 25 times the quantity, the volume of the Mississippi, you mean in a year or in a day?
It's a rate, so it's per second.
Can you give us the simple categories that you use to define atmospheric rivers?
We have developed a scale for atmospheric rivers to help with situational awareness communication, and it goes from 1 to 5, and we call it AR1, AR2, so on and so forth. AR1s and 2s are primarily beneficial for Western water supply. AR4s and 5s often are hazardous, and in the middle, they can be a mix.
And, you know, the other thing I wonder about a lot, and this has driven me to do this interview, is why we are hearing about atmospheric rivers so much. I feel like the past handful of years, that term atmospheric rivers has been in the news, in weather, in conversations. And prior to that time, I don't really recall hearing it. I've heard other people say that there was the Pineapple Express that was the same thing, different name. Can you give a little background on why now and the past?
Well, first of all, it's happening now because the role of these storms has really come more and more into focus. And your sort of run-of-the-mill everyday storms aren't the ones that have the biggest impact. There are a few storms each year on the West Coast that have a big impact, and we have come to define them as atmospheric rivers. So in the early 1990s, some scientists coined the term atmospheric river because they saw the concept of these relatively narrow regions doing a lot of the horizontal water vapor transport in the atmosphere, and it looked like rivers to them in their models. After those first few papers, which culminated around 1998, the topic sort of faded in terms of interest from the broader science community. And it wasn't until around 2003, when I read the 1998 paper by Zhu and Newell, that the light bulb went off for me about what a profoundly useful concept it was relative to what I was studying. And I adopted the term in 2004 in the first paper I wrote on it, encountered, you know, the resistance to this, the subject line or the topic title, pushed through that and wrote a series of papers over a few years. And since then, the topic has been rejuvenated, fundamentally because we now have observations from satellites that show these long, narrow features of large water vapor content blown by the wind. Literally look like rivers, you know, from satellite view, but they're rivers in the atmosphere. And I've led programs to measure these things offshore using aircraft and to look at them in models and in other ways. And the concept has just really taken off because it's a natural way to visualize how water vapor is moved around in the Earth's atmosphere.
Today's episode is sponsored by Downriver Equipment. Downriver manufactures hand-built custom frames, straps, drop bags, rig bags, and pumps all in Denver, Colorado. This April, Downriver Equipment is hosting Raftopia, one of the largest river gear sales and celebrations among the river community. Raftopia will begin on Tuesday, April 2nd, with a week-long sale culminating with a one-day outdoor exhibition and used gear sale with over $20,000 in prizes. I will be the MC at Raftopia representing the River Radius. Find Downriver Equipment and Raftopia online at www.downriverequip.com and in today's show notes.
Hey, this is Sam. I'm driving a 2023 Nissan Rogue. This is a four-door, all-wheel drive SUV. It has five seatbelts and a large cargo space in the back. Great car to load up with friends, family, and get to the river with all your gear. It has a high profile. You can see up and through traffic. It has a strong engine, smooth, consistent shifting with the transmission. Really solid car. Feels really safe in traffic with weight and without weight. The all-wheel drive adds a lot for the traction and for the handling and the performance. You can find your Denver area Nissan dealers online, www.nissanusa.com.
So let's get into the center that you have developed. This is the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes. Give me the background. I think you put this together. You kind of dreamed it, went forward with the dream, put all the pieces together, and now you have a huge team in several places on the planet, and then this other team up in the sky flying around looking at these atmospheric rivers. Tell us about the center and the work you're doing. Yeah, please.
So the center came into being because it had become clear to me some 15 or more years ago that water management in the West was a profoundly challenging thing, and that the storms that produce, you know, much of the rain and snow were not being studied fully in the meteorological community. I grew up partly in the Southwest, including in Arizona and California, and I saw firsthand how individual storms could really contribute to the total for the whole year in terms of water. And knowing how vital water is to the economy and the environment in the West, it really stuck with me for decades, that basic concept. when I left from my former position in the federal agency, NOAA, to come to Scripps Oceanography, it was to build this center to try to fill that relative gap in knowledge and effort to try to understand and predict these few big storms each year. Hence the title of the center, for Western Weather and Water Extremes. It's those big events that make or break the water year here in the West, in much of the West. And our science and our teams and our funding and our sponsors, we've learned about this along the way, and it becomes more and more in focus that knowing about these storms, where they are, when they're going to occur, how strong they're going to be, how many there will be through the winter, is really the linchpin to anticipating how much water we're going to have, you know, in the coming, you know, wet season here in the West. It only takes a few storms each year to determine whether we're in flood or drought in major parts of the Southwest in particular, and in other parts of the West. These storms have an outsized impact in our water supply availability during the normally dry summer season, and they also are the primary cause of flooding. And prior to our work on atmospheric rivers, the term Pineapple Express had been used for some of the big storms on the West Coast. But we've learned through science that that's basically one flavor of atmospheric river. Atmospheric rivers exist in other parts of the world. They don't have to just cross Hawaii, you know, to get to the West Coast. So the term Pineapple Express was really part of the foundation for recognizing that there are a few extra big and important storms in the West. In the field of meteorology, however, we haven't really latched on to the hurricanes and the nor'easters and the severe thunderstorms in the Great Plains. And each region of the country other than the West largely had some sort of especially important storm type that mattered. And on the West Coast, we didn't really have the clarity of that, which had been around for decades in the rest of the country. So the Pineapple Express was the closest thing that we had at the time to that. And we have refined that substantially, and this concept of atmospheric rivers really has proven out to be the way to understand and predict and articulate and communicate, is this a big one or is this just a run-of-the-mill storm? And it particularly is being found to be useful in the West, and this is why it's gaining in popularity and usage in the media and in the public, because it sort of comports with people's personal experiences.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think about that, because I can totally agree, feel that. I grew up in the Midwest with tornadoes, and then in the West, it was kind of like, oh, we have fires is what we have. And yeah. But there are these major storms.
And yet it's water that mm-hmm. we all depend upon.
Right, that we want more of.
Yeah. I mean, I had one winter in when I was at grad school at UCLA, where we got in 12 hours half of the entire precipitation for the year in Los Angeles. Mm. That stuck with me here, you know, almost 40 years later. Mm-hmm. And we see that time and time again. One or two big storms can really matter. We get several on average. If we don't get enough, we slip into drought. If we get too big or too many back to back, we end up in flood.
And we talk about how you are using airplanes to help understand this work. You've said, I've read that you have the buoy system in the water in the Pacific. You have your centers in San Diego and Northern California, Hawaii, you probably have other places, but that you also have these mobile laboratories flying above. Talk about the planes and the role that they perform for the research.
One of the challenges we have in observing and predicting atmospheric rivers is that in the West Coast, they largely form up over the Pacific Ocean. And unlike over the continents where we have weather balloons and lots of data on the ground and weather radars and all sorts of information that we don't have over the oceans, you know, we're left without as much awareness of the details of the atmospheric river storms and what's influencing them over the ocean. Thank goodness for satellites and for buoys, because those are really critical. We need those fully, but they don't tell the whole story about the atmospheric rivers. It turns out satellites, a fair bit of the satellite data is blocked by having clouds, high clouds. Other types of satellite data can see into the clouds and through the clouds and rain, but their precision is reduced because of the uncertainty of the measurement. Ocean surface buoys are really vital. They float on the ocean surface. They measure temperature, sea surface temperature, wind, currents, And there are some probes in the ocean that go way down deep that measure the structure and the vertical of the oceans. But we have so little information about the vertical structure of the atmosphere over the oceans. And that's where the atmospheric rivers form and live and move. So the atmospheric river phenomena is concentrated in the lowest 10,000 feet of the atmosphere, roughly, over the oceans. They're a few hundred miles wide and a couple thousand miles long on average. And we don't have adequate measurements of the strength or the position or the structure or the orientation of the atmospheric river offshore using standard satellite and buoy measurements. What we do to fill that gap is we have requested the aircraft that the nation has used for decades to track hurricanes in the summer and fall. We're now using them in the winter. I started this program with a colleague, Vijay Talapragada in the National Weather Service, and we now have a large team that works on this with the U.S. Air Force Weather Reconnaissance Reserve and NOAA's Aircraft Operations Center. And we fly these aircraft out into the storms, or really over the storms, and the environments nearby, the ARs that influence the AR itself. These flights happen each winter now. It's an operational program. It's co-led by myself and our center here and the National Weather Service. This year, we've flown almost 40 missions, 40 days, some days with two or three aircraft at a time. And we measure the atmospheric river conditions offshore very precisely.
You're flying these planes out. I think you're taking off from Hawaii. You're also using airstrip in Northern California. Do you also fly out of San Diego? And then what's happening when you're up in the air? How are you sensing the data?
So our AR recon, we call it, Atmospheric River Reconnaissance, or AR recon. We deploy aircraft out of Hawaii and Sacramento primarily, and they fly different parts of the storm, the AR, and the environment around the AR. And they take a couple hours oftentimes to get to the target. And then they spend about 4 to 6 hours over the AR or nearby. And then they come back to their base and land. Typically, the NOAA G4 aircraft flies for 7 or 8 hours. And the Air Force C-130s fly for 8 to 10 hours. They do that back-to-back days if we need for several days. In the case of NOAA, we have the one aircraft in Hawaii typically for several weeks or a couple months. And the Air Force, we've had as many as 3 or 4 aircraft on the ground in Sacramento to make sure we've got equipment available to fly each day. So when the aircraft gets out near the AR, it starts releasing dropsondes. They're essentially little cardboard canisters, essentially, that are about the size of 2 Coke cans stacked on each other. They have a little parachute, and they carry a temperature sensor, moisture, wind, and pressure. And as they descend in about 20 minutes, they radio that data back to the aircraft. The person on board quality controls that and then sends it via satellite communication link to a big data bucket for weather models that the whole world's weather models use to start their new forecast. So these aircraft data are getting directly into the operational data flow that is helping make forecasts better of these storms.
And this is all happening, like what you're saying, that these are dropping out of the plane, quality control happens on the plane, the data is sent by satellite back to other weather people, and this is immediately being put into play, this information.
That's right. When the data are collected, there's a 6-hour time window centered on 4 p.m. Pacific time, which is zero UTC or Greenwich time. That's a standard measurement time all over the world for special weather observations. So we collect all this data. The meteorological community collects tons of data right at that same time, uniformly around the world. And we're adding our data, the AR recon data, to that flow. So these data are, in fact, flowing straight into the weather models, where this data that are collected in a 6-hour window can be used in a forecast model run that is initialized at 4 p.m. Pacific time in the winter, 00 UTC globally.
The other question then is that the flights are not, they're not scheduled far ahead of time. You all as a crew, as a team at the center, are watching these ARs come in, and the whole crew says, okay, we're ready, let's go. there might be back-to-back-to-back-to-back flights. There also might be days on end where everyone's just sitting on the ground. Am I right to think that way?
Yes. Our AR recon missions are tailored each day to the specific weather conditions that are present. If there's no AR or no storm that's of importance in the region, we won't fly. So we only fly when there are good targets, and we want to improve the forecast of those things.
And so there's a season to atmospheric rivers. What is the season? How many ARs happen in a season?
So in California, per se, we might get on the order of, you know, in one location in Northern California, a dozen or 15 ARs in a winter. In Southern California, it might be half that. The size of the ARs matters and their strength. So not every AR is equal. And if you count it across the West Coast, it's on the order of probably 40 or 50, you know, per year. They might last a day or two or three, depending on the circumstances. And the season is largely starts in the Northwest, even as early as September, but really October, it starts to get rolling, and November, December, that sort of peaks up in the Northwest. And then by the time you get to California, it's more like a December, January, February, you know, peak. So the AR season for the West Coast is really October through March, maybe even into April. The goal for AR recon is to have a full season run from 1st of November to the 31st of March. Mm-hmm. That's our hardcore AR season on the West Coast.
I heard you say that ARs are kind of like a Southwest phenom, maybe not phenom, but a Southwest storm. Do you call them atmospheric rivers when they're up in the Pacific Northwest as well?
Yes, the term atmospheric river applies anywhere on the world where the criteria are met.
Okay.
Large volume of water vapor transport is really the key parameter. And they occur not only in the Northwest and Alaska, but also in the Southeast and the East Coast. Some of the biggest, wettest, strongest nor'easters have a strong atmospheric river embedded in them. Mm-hmm. And that's a topic of emerging interest and work. Other parts of the world have atmospheric rivers off the, you know, that hit the west coast of Europe or west coast of South America or southern Africa, Australia, New Zealand, et cetera. They are a phenomena that occurs not just in the West.
Last year, there was a lot of atmospheric rivers. This year, there's been some atmospheric rivers. Since I've come aware of your center, I now get the updates via email that tell me, in the coming week, there's this kind of AR that's going to make landfall. I find that to be fascinating. And I look at your center, you can get a bit of a forecast there. And you talked at the beginning of the episode about the scale AR1 to, I think, AR5. What are the factors going on that will influence an AR to become greater, smaller on the scale?
The scale is based on the strength of the AR as measured by how much water vapor it transports horizontally and by how long it's overhead. It's pretty intuitive as a person that if a heavy rain band sort of stalls over your spot, you're more likely to get flooding. Think of the AR as sort of a broad rain band. And if it's overhead longer, you're going to get more storm total precipitation and the impacts are going to be higher. So the AR scale factors in the strength of the atmospheric river in terms of how much water vapor transport and how long it's overhead. This two-dimensional criteria is really based on the science from a decade of work prior to creating the scale that showed that the dominant cause for changes in total precipitation for a storm were the combination of the strength of the AR and the duration of it over the location.
Hey folks, this is Sam. Right now I'm driving a 2023 Nissan Rogue up a river canyon. Here we go, we're gonna do some passing. This car is really strong and smooth with its transmission. It feels very powerful, very safe, and very steady. Easy to drive, handles great. Has a small footprint in the lane, and yet it really feels like a big car. It's got big windows. I was driving it yesterday with four big guys. It handled the load great. It handled the space of us really well. This is the kind of car you can put your boats on the roof. You can load the back hatch with lots of river gear. The other thing I've noticed about this car is that it has an incredible turning radius. You can find your Denver area Nissan dealers online at www.nissanusa.com.
This episode is sponsored by Downriver Equipment, a river gear shop in Denver, Colorado. Downriver custom builds boat frames and dry boxes for cataracts and rafts. These frames use larger diameter aluminum tubing and can be customized with welded diamond plate decking and floors. Personally, I row a Clear Creek Downriver frame and it's perfectly designed for whitewater. Downriver is hosting Raftopia in the beginning of April. Raftopia is Downriver's annual major gear sale loaded with new and used gear. Raftopia culminates on Saturday, April 6th with an outdoor parking lot sales event. Find Downriver equipment online at www.downriverequip.com and in today's show notes. I'm gathering that there is a direct relationship between an ocean and an atmospheric river. That is the delivery. That's the source of the water. It lifts up into the atmospheric river, becomes the storm. So when this atmospheric river hits the continent, does it change? Is the definition of the storm type changed? And then also, what is happening to the storm when it hits land and starts to move across the landscape?
The water vapor in an atmospheric river largely comes from evaporation off the ocean, and it gets collected up into this long, narrow ribbon with strong winds that moves it along at remarkable amounts. Like I mentioned, 25 Mississippi rivers worth of water vapor transport is an average atmospheric river does. When the air in the atmospheric river is forced upward, either by the fluid dynamics itself causing it to go up by convergence, we call it, or more simply, when it hits the mountains on the West Coast, it's forced upward. And when it's forced upward, the air cools and condenses the vapor into liquid cloud drops or into ice particles. And that starts the process of precipitation formation. So the stronger the atmospheric river is going more perpendicular to the mountain range, the more the air is going to go up and the more precipitation you're going to get out of that. And then when the air goes over the mountain crest, it starts descending and warming up, which reduces the amount of rain and snow on the lee side of that mountain range. It creates what's called a rain shadow, which I imagine many people in the West are familiar with. So that rain shadow is a gap in the rainfall or reduced rainfall. But then when the AR hits another mountain range, it can ascend that mountain range as well and cause more precipitation further inland. In much of the West, we have coastal mountain ranges right on the coast that go up, you know, a few thousand or a couple thousand feet. And then we have things like the Cascade Mountains and the Shasta Mountains and the Sierra Nevada Mountains that are farther inland and much taller that can wring out even more water vapor. Interestingly, there are gaps in these mountains through which the water vapor in an atmospheric river can be transported farther inland. And it's a super fascinating area of current study to explore how those pathways of inland penetration of atmospheric rivers behave. And as the water vapor is wrung out from precipitation, you know, further west, the water vapor in the AR is less and less. And we're working scientifically now to try to understand, well, is it still an AR when it gets inland farther, or is it something different? And we're settling on a very intuitive sort of approach to it, but I won't go into the details here, just to say that, you know, the climatology of water vapor content at 7,000 feet in the west slope of the Rockies, there's a lot less water vapor on average than there is at the coast at sea level because you have much less atmosphere. So we have to sort of normalize things, and we're figuring that all out right now. But it's clear ARs contribute a lot of snow to the Sierra Nevada and even into the Rockies and into Arizona and Idaho and the like.
Yeah, you know, as you say that, I'm thinking last year, the 2023 winter that really dumped a lot of snow in California, huge percentages across the mountains, and so much water, moisture penetrated all the way across the Great Basin and into and across the Rockies. And it was a fascinating thing to watch, because I live in the Rockies, and to want that snow just keep coming. And then this year, about 2 weeks ago, when San Diego was flooding, I was watching the storms, trying to see, are those going to come through the Salt River Basin? Are those going to work their way up to the Four Corners? And it was just amazing to hunt around and find different websites that could show how these rivers were turning. and how they kind of missed where I live. We were waiting and waiting, and it missed us, but it hit a little bit west. So with that description, with your description, and reflecting on the satellite imagery on your website, I think of this AR as this akin to like a garden hose where you put your thumb on the end and you're just spraying the hose over the coast. Like it's really focused in certain spots, or like a dragon fire breath, which I've only seen in movies, that is real focused in certain areas. And so am I right to think that when an AR comes in and starts to pound the coast and the mountains there, that it's coming in initially very focused, and then almost by impact of hitting something solid like a mountain range or the continent, that it kind of gets diffused out a little bit and gets more broad. Is that a fair assumption, observation?
I'm not quite going to go with the dragon's breath thing, but I appreciate the colorfulness of that. The AR is a bit like a fire hose, because where it hits is where the heavy precipitation happens. And it turns out that there are a couple of corridors for inland penetrating ARs. One that is particularly visible to me, because I am familiar with Steamboat Colorado and the Yampa River, which is a super important tributary of the Colorado River. Like 10% of the inflow into Lake Powell comes from that one tributary. It turns out if an AR comes from the west roughly and hits the Oregon-Washington area, it can penetrate over the Cascades and through gaps in the Cascades into southeastern Washington state and go around the mountains there and come arcing a bit south of east into the southern part of Idaho. And that's not very mountainous. And then from there, it can keep moving just on the north edge of the Wasatch Mountains and go into, you know, relative gap in the Rocky Mountains in southwestern Wyoming and land straight into the Park Range right above Steamboat. And it turns out the snowtell site called Tower above Steamboat is the wettest spot in Colorado. And that very corridor, if you looked at it on a map, you would see there's actually, you can imagine an AR flowing through there and getting all the way to the Park Range without losing as much water vapor as it would if it crossed over, say, the Sierras. And that's one corridor that we know now is quite effective. Another is coming up from the south. If an AR gets far enough south into northern or central Baja and comes north-northeast into Arizona, it lines straight up with the Mogollon Rim, perpendicular, and it can create amazing amounts of snow and rain. Just a few weeks ago, we had an event where in 2 days, the snowpack in the Mogollon Rim and Prescott and Flagstaff, they got half of an entire year's worth of snow in 2 days. And it was a strong AR that was penetrating inland upward from the south, more or less, south-southwest, along the Gulf of California, across the very low-altitude Sonoran Desert in southwestern Arizona, straight into those mountains of the Mogollon Rim and the San Francisco Peaks, and then on into the San Juan Mountains of southwest Colorado.
Yeah, then that's right where I am, and we got 4 to 5 inches at 6,500 feet of wet snow. It was awesome.
And that's a big, you know, in parts of the southwest, that's a significant storm. So those are two pathways that are pretty direct. But there's another one, and your idea about splashing against the mountains, it's not exactly what's going on, but it's sort of interesting. In the coast ranges of California, there's a low point around the San Francisco area, and it's maybe 100, 200 miles north-south, and an AR can come in through there, and it turns out that there can form on the west slope of the Sierra Nevada what's called the Sierra Barrier Jet, very well-known phenomena for many years. But we did a field study a while back to study whether or not how the AR is affected by all that. And what we see is the AR in some ways rides up and over that barrier jet and then over the Sierras, but the Sierra Barrier Jet itself can be moistened. And there's a bit of the merging of an AR into the Sierra Barrier Jet in a way that we haven't quite observed directly, but we think it's happening. It actually moves north along the base of the Sierra and then makes a right turn at an obscure place called the Burney Gap, which is between the Northern Sierra and the Shasta Mountains. And lots of water vapor flows through that gap into, it turns out, into very northwest Nevada and into the southern part of the mountains of Idaho. So some of the biggest precipitation events in southern Idaho are from ARs penetrating through the Burney Gap, partly having been diverted by the Sierra Barrier Jet around the Sierras, a bit like, you know, splashing on that ridge, but preferentially turning left because that's, you know, how things line up.
And so when these ARs are able to move through these corridors, they're just, my perception is that they are avoiding hitting something. Like their momentum is not slowed by a landform.
In many situations, the atmosphere resists being pushed upward. When the atmosphere is structured such that it doesn't resist that upward motion very much, then an airstream hitting, you know, a complicated mountainous terrain, some of it's going to go up and over a ridge and others going to go through a gap.
Mm-hmm.
If the air is resistant to upward motion, more of it's going to go through the gap than up and over.
Mm.
And it's a pretty complicated thing. It's the temperatures aloft and et cetera. But the thing about atmospheric rivers is they come with a structure that is not resistant to vertical motion, meaning it's very prone to be lifted when it hits the mountains. So it's a really a complicated combination of going through gaps and over ridges. And we honestly haven't really figured all that out yet.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting and exciting. So, you know, this is a big program. When I look at your staff, you've got a lot of people. You're flying planes out of several places. You have a massive program going on. Lots of federal, state organizations. I think your Scripps is involved. My assumption is that this is not just to have cool conversations about atmospheric rivers. I think you and I could probably talk about this for a long time, but that there's another outcome you're looking to provide to weather forecasters, but then also to water managers, to people who are in charge of like flood control, search and rescue, people who take care of humans. Talk about that side of the purpose of your work, please.
Sure thing. Yeah, I mean, atmospheric rivers, you know, I'm a scientist type. They're super cool and interesting. You can see them with the right data. You can fly over them and sample them. We can try to predict them and all that. But it's not because it's cool, as much as I'd like it to be. It's because knowing how much rain and snow is going to hit what area is super useful. And I literally came to Scripps Oceanography to start this center with that purpose in mind. And in a particular concept that I developed called forecast-informed reservoir operations. Because a number of reservoirs in the West and across the country have traditionally not been able to use forecasts officially to be operated because when the dams were built, the forecasts were terrible. And it would have been unwise to try to, you know, modulate a flood based on a forecast of precipitation that was completely unreliable. Well, that was decades ago now, and now forecasts have gotten better. And it turns out that I was able to start with a bunch of colleagues, a program to pursue that and hypothesized that if we had accurate enough forecasts of the big rain events in this watershed in Northern California called Lake Mendocino, where Sonoma Water Agency runs it for water supply and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for flood control, that it would be possible in that place where they're prone to drought and flood, that there could be novel ways to operate the reservoirs so that there would be more flood control and more water supply reliability. The typical problem faced in a Western reservoir where it's there for both water supply and flood control is in the winter, you know, maybe half of the reservoir is kept empty in preparation for a possible big storm and a flood. And that empty space fills up and it reduces the flood damage downstream. But then after the storm hits, that water by rule has to be released when it's safe to do so, restoring the emptiness of the upper half of the reservoir in case there's another storm coming. But a lot of times there's no other storm coming before spring and the end of the rainy season. So that water that was in there for flood control and then released isn't available for the summer. The basic idea is if we knew there was no big storm coming for a few days and we had enough skill in predicting it when it was coming, the reservoir operator could release water ahead of a storm. So in other words, there's a big storm that hit, let's say. It's filled a portion of the flood pool, it's called, the empty space. And the operator hypothetically could look ahead a few days and say, oh, there's no storm coming. I'm going to keep some of this extra water for another day. And then another day and another day. And if no big storm comes before spring, then that water is available for the summer. If there is another big storm coming before spring, there's plenty of time to release that extra water before the storm hits to get that water out of harm's way. That's what we've proven out on Lake Mendocino in Northern California, to the point where in one of the driest years on record, after the big storm hit in the winter, enough water was kept to be the equivalent of 20% more water than normal going into summer. And then in a super wet year, we had a flood year where the system allowed for something like a 15% increase in availability in the summer without any additional problems from flooding. So this has really demonstrated the connection between skillful forecasts of atmospheric rivers, because atmospheric rivers are the flood makers, remember, and the big ones that provide much of the water supply. Good forecasts of atmospheric rivers enables operators of reservoirs potentially to use the forecast to mitigate drought and mitigate flood. And those are profoundly important to many people, of course, and it hinges on the skill of predicting atmospheric rivers.
So 2023 winter was big, lots of storms, lots of snow across the West. 2024 is looking different. Southern California has been hit with a few of these atmospheric rivers that have done, they've loaded up the Los Angeles River, which is fascinating to see, partly because it's just a huge concrete conduit at this point. And it's doing its job, is getting the water out of town so it doesn't flood. But there's also the questions about trying to capture it. San Diego's been hit with big flooding. I looked at the weather today, and it looks like a lot of kind of middle to Southern California is under, some sort of hazard alerts. There's a lot of moisture happening. The northern part of California and up into towards Seattle look like rain, but not hazardous. So two questions. Is this an atmospheric river that's hitting you right now? And what are your thoughts kind of forecasting for the rest of this AR season in 2024?
So yeah, this stormy period over the last couple days is sort of like a short, wide atmospheric river associated with what's called a cutoff low offshore. And it has the characteristics of an atmospheric river. So yes, it's an AR1 or an AR2, but it's coming on an environment that's super wet already and prone to flooding. So that's the caveat with our AR scale. Mm-hmm. An AR4 or 5 hitting in the fall when the soils are super dry, you end up without much big runoff in the rivers because the soil soaks it up. You get an AR1 or 2 hit right after an AR4 or 5 in a very wet environment, and it can put the rivers over the edge and trigger a lot of flooding. So on average, there's like a 10 times increase for every ranking on the scale in terms of flood damages, but there are exceptions, so people should be aware of that. When it comes to the rest of the season, it's really hard to predict that. And the ocean temperatures really influence the weather patterns, like El Nino, La Nina can do that. And we've seen indications that it would be wetter in the Southwest than normal. And we're now sort of accumulating enough in these storms where it's getting close to that. Northern Sierra was, I think, 90% of normal as of yesterday. And Southern Sierra was maybe in the 70% range. The Colorado River Basin is nearly 100% of normal. Arizona is now, I think, well above normal. So we are seeing a bit of that pattern has taken place already. And the real question is what's going to come in the next several weeks. And right now, I don't have a good crystal ball. You know, looking out another week or two, I don't see anything big coming. But, things can surprise us. About especially in week two.
What's the kind of quick answer? What's the relationship of La Nina and El Nino to atmospheric rivers?
It's complicated. And in fact, we've had in Southern California, the last three of our wettest years have all been La Ninas, which is backwards compared to what, the expectation is. And the two El Nino years prior to this one were unusually dry. And we've just are in the process of studying that. And it turns out those two dry El Ninos sort of lacked normal amount of AR activity in Southern California. And the three wet La Ninas had way more AR activity than normal. So it actually looks a bit more like ARs are the disruptor of the correlation between El Nino, La Nina, and annual precipitation in Southern California. We haven't studied any place else. That's just the preliminary assessment.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. For you personally, a couple of questions about your own fascination relationship with atmospheric rivers. I saw a video somewhere of you talking. You know, there's a lot of these videos because of the nature of the work you do, where you're giving like speeches, lectures around the topic of atmospheric rivers. And one of them, you said something like, you like tap water. You like having water in your house and knowing that it will be there. And so it drives you to study atmospheric rivers. Can you just briefly maybe touch on what you're saying there?
Down from Michigan originally, where there's usually plenty of water, and then moved to Arizona, where there's often not enough. And I really appreciate the whole water industry, its ability to make fresh water available from my tap so I can have drinking water or a shower or whatever. And I think it's easy to take that for granted. And I really am motivated to help provide information for the water management community to know better what the atmosphere is going to deliver so that they are better able to do their jobs to ensure that we have reliable fresh water.
And the other thing I think about is there's a huge group of you all. I mean, I don't know, 70-ish maybe on your staff. It's something big, and it's impressive. And then I think about what kind of conversations are you all having inside your labs and your research centers and in your meetings. And the question is really like, what is the affinity that you find you and your peers have with and for atmospheric rivers? Like the things that might surprise us on the outside as we look in, we're like, ooh, it's raining or it's big storms. But you all have come to understand these ARs in a way unique to your group of people. What's the affinity that you all, that you see people having on your crew?
Well, I appreciate that, Sam. I think the most common denominator amongst us is that we want to do science and produce solutions that are relevant and valuable in a pragmatic way to the rest of the world. And because water is so priceless in the West, and these ARs are the central storm type to deliver, the majority of it, we know that our work is making a difference for people who have to manage through the extremes of wet and dry. We also know that climate change is causing these extremes to become more extreme. And the work we're doing has purpose, it has impact, and it's been very motivating for myself. And the people who come to the center tend to want to make the world a better place and pursue science with practical outcomes in mind. And we've had the good fortune to be able to set up an environment to do that. Scripps Institution of Oceanography and University of California, San Diego are remarkably fertile, supportive environments for us all to be employed, to do work that is very purposeful and meaningful. And I'd like to think that that's sort of the glue that holds us together.
Is there anything else you think we should talk about in our conversation today?
One thing I'd like to add, one of the things that we're doing here at the center is working hand in hand with entities that have day-to-day operational requirements and responsibilities, whether it's the reservoir operators at the Army Corps of Engineers or California Department of Water Resources or local water agencies who have to make decisions every day on their water. We're working hand in hand with them as scientists. Similarly, with the National Weather Service and their production of forecasts every day, they have to reliably produce those forecasts. We're working hand in hand with them. We work with the Air Force to design and carry out the flights with the aircraft. So we've developed an approach here called a Research and Operations Partnership, R-A-O-P, and the A is capitalized because it's and. We are working hand in hand together. We get to know what the operational needs are. The operational experts get to know what the research is developing and what could be done. And over time, with adequate resources, we've been able to move the needle on some things that have been super hard to make progress on prior to my career. So this partnering between research and operations entities is really the central success story, in my opinion.
I can see that. I can imagine that is so important. All right, that's all I have. Are you good with that?
I'm good with it. Sam, I really appreciate your approach to this interview. I'm hopeful it fills the gap a bit of what you identified, which I think is a real thing. And look forward to seeing you, I guess, next time we get to connect.
Yeah, next time. Yeah, Marty Ralph, thank you so much for your time today on the podcast and giving us a lesson on atmospheric rivers.
Hats off.
An atmospheric river size thank you goes out to Marty Ralph and the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes. We have two sponsors today, Downriver Equipment and their Raftopia event coming this April, and the Denver area Nissan dealers. You can find links for both of these sponsors in the show notes and on our website. All River Radius social media is supported by Samantha Seiss. All River Radius music comes from the lap steel guitar of Gene Reiniger. Be in touch anytime. hello@theriverradius.com. Thanks so much for joining the River Radius. Like a dragon fire breath, which I've only seen in movies.
25 Mississippi rivers worth of water vapor transport is what an average atmospheric river does. I'm not quite going to go with the dragon's breath thing. An atmospheric river is really a river in the sky.